Hey, welcome to another episode of Stuck at Home. Today, I'm talking to an old friend of mine, Maria Konnikova, who's a writer for The New Yorker and an author, and now she's a world-class poker player. Hey, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to see you again, even if this time it's not in person, but from across the country.
Right. And the last time I talked to you at length, when you were about to publish Mastermind,
my first book. Yeah, you've known me right from the start.
Yeah, we bonded over our love for Sherlock Holmes and many variations of Sherlock Holmes on top of that. I mean, I love Gregory Howe's variation more than real Sherlock Holmes. But
how could you not love Hugh Laurie? I mean, Hugh Laurie is just amazing. I will watch Hugh Laurie in anything any day.
See, that's why I can't disagree with you on anything. We agree on everything. Maybe except on poker, because I don't know how to play it. So.
Hey, I didn't know how to play either before I took this on. So there you go.
Yeah. Hey, before we get into all that, just bring me up to speed. What have you been up to in the time since we saw each other, which is about, 6 years now?
Yeah. So I had one more book come out called The Confidence Game, and that one was about con artists. So after you saw me, I spent the next few years in the den of vice, learning about con artists, spending time with con artists and their victims, and figuring out how they work, why they do what they do, how they do what they do, how they're able to convince really smart people to fall for what they do. So that happened. And that was kind of the big highlight of the last 6 years. And then after that, I had a patch where not much happened because I had a run of very bad health and had some strange autoimmune disease that was never diagnosed, but became allergic to everything. Just couldn't go outside because my body would react to any material. I'd be covered in hives. It was miserable. And that was actually the birth of this book, The Biggest Bluff, which is coming out June 23rd. And that was supposed to be a year-long foray into the world of poker to explore the role of luck, which was inspired by kind of this bad luck that I had, and turned into multiple years. And I somehow managed to become good and win some major titles and become a professional poker player. And that brings us to today.
And she says that so modestly, but more importantly, how's your health now?
It was never diagnosed, so we still don't know what went wrong, but my hormone levels seem to have stabilized and everything seems okay. So knock on wood, we're not quite sure, because my doctors don't know what happened, we don't know if it will happen again. But here's hoping it doesn't.
Indeed. I think it's very difficult to go through life with, illnesses and not knowing what's happening to you. So more power to you. We'll talk about the new book, but let's talk about The Confidence Game.
Yeah.
I know it was a bestseller, but in researching that book and watching all these television shows about con artists and confidence artists on, what do you think? Like, how much of the TV people get it right, and is there anything real? I think there's so many of those shows out there now.
There are a lot of those shows, and it's funny that you mention them, because actually I've had a few actors reach out to me over the years telling me that they read The Confidence Game for inspiration to figure out how to act their character. So those shows, of course, are the best, and they're very true to life because they read my book. I'm just kidding. But I think some of them get it. I think there's some things they get right, which is that, con artists are very good at what they do. And, oftentimes you'll watch these shows and you'll say, oh my God, this con artist is so unbelievable. How can they convince people? Well, they convince people of unbelievable things all the time. I was actually inspired to write The Confidence Game because of a movie, because of David Mamet's House of Games. And I thought, oh, it couldn't possibly be the case that someone as intelligent as the woman who's the star of the movie, who has a PhD in psychology, best-selling author, all sorts of things that should make her not a good victim, that she falls for a con. And I remember watching that movie and saying, oh, this is a brilliant movie, but how likely is that? And then realizing, oh my God, this is so true to life. This happens all the time. And so I think that the things we find unbelievable are actually the most believable. I think what they often get wrong is a lot of the victims. They will often do the same thing that pop culture does in other areas, such as journalism and just media coverage, which is glamorize the con artist and blame the victim. Say, oh, you know, you can't fool an honest man. Well, they must be gullible. They must be greedy. You know, if it seems too good to be true, it is. Didn't you see the red flags? It's always put on the victim. And I think that that part actually a lot of places get wrong and a lot of shows get wrong because the victims are often blameless. You know, it's yes, they were wrong, but not for bad motives. And we could have easily been in their place.
Wow. And you know, so since then, like how long did that book take to write?
From start to finish, about 3 years. I mean, from the time I started researching con artists to the time the book came out. So I probably spent writing, I actually spent a lot of time interviewing and doing kind of the legwork, and that took, I have hundreds of hours of interviews. So I, you know, traveled across the country there, met with a lot of people. That took the longest amount of time. And then the writing probably took a little over a year.
And so what about the new book? You know, I know you mentioned that you were not well. And so I'm guessing you were at home for a long period of time.
I was. So, and I was reading.
Yeah. And so tell me a little bit about your journey into the world of poker and the new book. How long was that for?
3 years. So I first conceived of the project in 2016. Well, actually, it's 2020 now, so 4 years since conception. And I conceived of it in very broad terms. I didn't know I was going to be writing about poker. I knew I wanted to write about luck, about the role that chance plays in our lives, about how we learn to tell the difference between the things we can control and the things we can't control. How do you learn to maximize the things that you do control? And I didn't know quite how I was going to get at it because that's such a huge topic. You know, that's, you know, a life's work. It's not really a book. And so I was at home, as you said, for a long time and just read a lot. Just read and read and read anything that people recommended to me about chance, or anything that, you know, if I read a writer and he recommended something, I would go and read that. And eventually in my chain of reading, I came to John von Neumann's Theory of Games, the foundational book of game theory, and learned that von Neumann was a huge poker player. So von Neumann, one of the greatest minds of the 20th century, the father of game theory, one of the inventors of the computer, of the hydrogen bomb, I mean, brilliant man, that he was a huge poker player, and that game theory came from poker. It was inspired by that game. And he had a very interesting passage or kind of reflection in the book where he compared poker to other games and explained why he didn't care for games. He thought that most games were actually very bad models for decision making. He said chess is actually quite boring to him because it can be solved. It's a game of perfect information. All of the pieces are out there. And sure, it can be very interesting to play, but he's not interested in that because that's not what human decision making is like. You can never see the whole chessboard. When you're, you know, in nuclear negotiations, you have no idea where the pieces are or what they look like. And on the other end of the continuum, things like roulette, casino games, he also didn't like because that's just a crapshoot. You know, that's just pure chance. There's nothing you can do. And so that's also boring. But poker was a game of incomplete information. So there's information that I know, there's information that you know, information that we have in common, and we need to make decisions to the best of our abilities based on what we can tell, but knowing that that's never going to be complete. And he said, that's life. real life is a game of incomplete information, of little tactics of deception, of figuring out what does this man think I mean to do. And when I read that quote, I thought, oh, this is really interesting. I want to read more about poker. So I started reading about poker and I thought, this might be my book. Why don't I learn to play this game that I've never played before, that I've never had any interest in? Why don't I do that and use that as my journey, as my exploration of chance? Because if it's such a good metaphor for life or for those themes in life that I want to explore, then this might actually be a good way in. And that brought me to the world of poker.
You mentioned like poker is the game of incomplete information. I mean, you can apply that to a lot of things, you know, especially in the modern world, which is increasingly being dominated by algorithms, you know, and how we have to make decisions. I mean, even as human beings, we make decisions based on incomplete information on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So, like, what are the lessons like you've learned along the way in writing this book and playing poker that actually apply to our day-to-day life on one end, and then, you know, the algorithmic control on our lives on the other end?
Yeah, I mean, the entire book is basically lessons I've learned along the way. It turns out that, you know, poker was a much better guide for this than I ever thought possible. Because one of the things I realized was, you know, poker, yes, it's a game of incomplete information like life. It models a lot of life decisions, but it's simplified. It's a game, right? So it's actually a cleaner environment. There's not a lot of external noise. And so you actually learn how to make decisions much more correctly than you would in any sort of real life environment, which is much noisier. It's harder to figure out what the feedback is. It's harder to actually disentangle, you know, what is your fault, what you can take credit for versus what's just the outcome. In poker, you actually learn to disambiguate the decision process from the decision outcome. So you can make the best decision possible. And what you're always aiming for is, when the money goes in the middle of the table, am I the statistical favorite? And poker actually teaches you to figure out what statistics, what probabilities feel like, which is something that we struggle with in daily life. I mean, it's so hard to try to explain to someone, you know, what 5% feels like, what 10% feels like, 25%, 50, 75. These are all vastly different. 1% matters. It's a huge difference. And, you know, at the beginning when I started playing poker, there were certain things where, you know, someone would say something like, oh, if two cards are suited, it gives you a 2% edge. And I would say, oh, well, then it doesn't matter. You know, 2% is nothing. 2% doesn't matter. And then by the end, I realized 2% is huge. Give me any percent that I can possibly get. So poker teaches you that because you actually sample correctly. So you're learning from experience, which is how the brain works best and how it learns best, because you're playing hundreds of hands over and over and over. And so you start to figure out, this is what 2% feels like. This is what 5% feels like. And your goal is to make the best decision you can so that you're the favorite. If the money goes in and you're, say, a 75% favorite, that's wonderful, but you can still lose. And it teaches you that. It teaches you that the cards can still go against you, but you made the right decision. And so if you had to make the same decision, would you? Absolutely. You have to make that same decision over and over and over, because 75% of the time you're going to win. And when you translate that to actual real life, not the poker table, that's very powerful, because if you can learn to get into the habit of, whenever you make a decision, actually going through the decision process, going through the thought process and thinking, did I make the right decision, regardless of the outcome, regardless of what ended up happening? Or did I make the wrong decision, even though the outcome was good? That's going to actually help you improve, help you become a better thinker, help you gain clarity over your mind in a lot of ways, that kind of metacognitive awareness of your own thought process. So that's huge. And I think the other part of it is actually kind of on the opposite end. So this is like the rational end of the decision-making spectrum. The other part of it is emotional control. I actually studied, when I got my PhD at Columbia, I studied self-control and risky decision-making. So I studied delay of gratification in under hot emotional conditions. I had people play stock market games. So this is something I'd spent a lot of time on. And it's funny that I didn't actually learn what it felt like to implement a lot of these things until I played poker. Because in poker, it becomes so important, and you can see it in your bottom line. You can see it in your bank account. It's very closely tied to what you're actually making if you end up becoming emotional, if you start letting emotions get the better of you. And so poker really, if you want to get good at it, you have to learn to identify your emotions and to take them out of your decision process, to figure out, how do I apply those techniques of self-control so that I can make a dispassionate decision that is based on logic and reason and not based on emotion that's not actually important to the decision.
So how does one not get emotional? I mean, you know, we are emotional creatures. That's what makes us human.
Absolutely. So I think the first step is to realize that that's the wrong way of looking at it. You will get emotional. I think you need to acknowledge that you are human and there's no way to become emotionless. Even Sherlock Holmes, that figure that you and I bonded over all those years ago, experienced emotions. It's not like he was a heartless person. He just knew how to identify them and then dismiss them. He would say, hello, emotion. You know, I see that I'm, you know, excited or this or that, that I feel connected to you. Now I'm just going to take that out now that I've identified it and I'm going to take it out of my decision process. And he wasn't always able to. You know, we have stories like his adventures with Irene Adler, where he clearly let emotion get into his decision process, even though he's a fictional character. So theoretically, he should have never let that happen. So that's, I think, the first step. Realize you're going to get emotional. So what you do instead is you learn to know yourself well enough. And this takes this takes work, because you have to actually sit down and ask yourself some questions. You know, what annoys me? In poker, there's this wonderful word called tilt. And it's a word that I didn't know before. And tilt just means letting emotion into your decision process. So you can be tilted. You can go on tilt. Something can tilt you. You can find something tilting. You can use it as any part of speech. And so what you need to figure out is, what are my triggers? What are the things, you know, how do I react in different situations? Are there certain types of people who get me mad? Are there certain interactions that get me upset? Are there certain things that make me really happy? Maybe after I win a big pot, I get really excited and I want to bully everyone. Or maybe I want to protect my chips. You know, I will have reactions to different things. Learn what those are so that you can learn to identify them when they're happening. And then develop a kind of a protocol, as much of a process as you can, around getting rid of them. So some of those can be distancing. So there are some techniques in psychology where you basically picture yourself as a fly on the wall looking down at the situation. That's called psychological distancing. And so then you kind of start seeing yourself in the third person, and that lets you cool your emotions a little bit, so that you're saying, okay, Maria's doing this, not, oh my God, I can't believe that guy is trying to bully me. What a jerk. Instead, you say, okay, you know, this is the interaction. Let's cool Maria down. And it really works. And sometimes that won't work. Sometimes you're actually so emotional that techniques like that are pointless. In which case, I actually do things that are physical distancing. So I will sometimes actually get up from the table, walk around, walk away, give myself space, and realize that I need to calm down. And the other thing you can do is actually prevent the emotion from happening to begin with. If you know what your triggers are and you see them happening, develop ways to avoid that situation. I use noise-canceling headphones, for instance. There are some people who really rub me the wrong way. If I put those headphones on, I can avoid that interaction to begin with so that they don't get under my skin, so that they don't tilt me, and I then don't have to deal with that.
So, you know, from what I understood was that if you actually take into account your emotions, and then actually, it's sort of like the, you know, the noise-canceling headphones, just figuring out what part of the frequency to mask over. So knowing what emotions are and then masking over those, you end up making a little bit more clear, more logical, and more mathematical decision.
Yes, exactly. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. I think that, you know, it's a false thing to aspire to say, I don't want to feel emotions, because actually sometimes our emotions are really essential to decision-making. Some of the research I came across as I was doing the background work for this book showed me that people who actually have lesions in their brain making them unable to experience emotion. So they actually have no risk meter whatsoever. They don't mind risking everything. They have nothing stops them. They go broke in gambling games. They don't do well because that negative emotion, that thing that holds you back, that makes you risk averse, that says, you know, this is scary. There's a reason for that. Sometimes it is right to stop and to walk away. Sometimes you shouldn't take the risk. You know, sometimes that emotion is actually helpful. And if you don't have that, you're going to go broke in poker and in life. And so I actually think that it's a false thing to aspire to say, I'm not going to feel anything at all, because emotions can be protective and can be very useful. You just need to recognize them and try to figure out, are they telling me something important about the situation or not?
So there is a really nice continuum in your career, right? From your work at Columbia, then the mastermind, the confidence game, and now the new book. I mean, you are essentially, you know, trying to, parse or unthread the complexity of human emotion and decision making. So, I mean, wrong in assuming that?
No, not at all. I think that's quite accurate.
Yeah. So tell me about when you were at Columbia, were you thinking that you're going to be a book author and, and, you know, a journalist? Like, was that part of the plan, or that just happened along the way because of, you know, how you approach your thinking?
No, I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. And when I was an undergraduate, I studied both psychology and writing, but I studied fiction. I actually thought I was going to be writing novels. That's what I wanted to do. So I graduated. I had a thesis in psychology and political science because I was looking at leadership decision making, you know, how leaders made decisions. And then I had a fiction portfolio of short stories. And I always thought that that's what I was going to do. And when I went to grad school, I always knew that I wanted to write and not to have a career in traditional academia, mostly because I really was put off by the world of academia. I felt like it was very insular. There was a lot of backstabbing. I didn't like the politics there at all. And I also didn't like the fact that you really had to focus so insanely hard on one thing, and that you had to just super specialize if you wanted to be successful. And one of the reasons that I chose the graduate advisor I chose, Walter Mischel, was because he was of a different generation. I mean, when he became my advisor, he was almost 80 years old. I was his last grad student. He was done. And he came up at a time where he got his first appointment with, I think, two or three papers under his belt at Stanford and then at Harvard. You know, he had this amazing career based on theory, based on a few major studies, and he never had to have this publish or perish mentality. And when I told him, I don't think I want to go into academia, he laughed and he said, you know, I wouldn't want to go into academia now either, because he really believed that people should follow their curiosity, that they should be well-rounded, that they should care about theory, that they should care about just slowing down and doing a lot of things. And he was an artist as well. He had amazing paintings. He did so much. And so the fact that he was willing to take me under his wing, I think, really helped me solidify that, you know, I could be interested in psychology and want to get this PhD and be really interested in the human mind, and yet have this very strong interest in writing and think that that's the direction that I ultimately wanted to go. And he completely supported that. Of course, I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know that I was going to start writing nonfiction. I didn't know that I was going to become a journalist. I didn't know I'd be writing books, not magazine pieces. None of that was planned. I still would like to go back to fiction at some point. I'd love to exercise that part of my mind one day.
I mean, you have such great experience to mine from, right? You know, from Confidence, you know, Games to Sherlock Holmes to your journey into poker. I mean, there is just so much material there for you to write a fiction book. But tell me a little bit about your time as a poker player. You know, to people who don't know you, tell us like how big a poker player you are, and I guess you're now a professional. And what does that really mean?
Well, I became a professional in the process of writing this book, which means that I went on leave from the New Yorker, and for a period of time, I was making all of my money from poker, the entirety of my income. I wasn't getting anything from writing. And so that was kind of the transition to professional. I joined Poker Stars Team Pro, which was, you know, a prestigious way of doing it, a sponsorship by one of the largest poker companies in the world. This is no longer the case. I'm no longer a Team Pro. I'm now back to writing, but I still love poker. So that was the trajectory. And the way that it happened was I was incredibly lucky that one of the best players in the world agreed to coach me, to mentor me, to be my guide on this journey, Eric Seidel. And we started working together, and I started playing and working really hard. This became my full-time job because I really wanted to do it right and to kind of put my all into it for the sake of the book. And all of a sudden, I started doing well, and I started winning some small tournaments, and then I started doing well in larger tournaments. And then about a year from the moment I first started playing, so a year from the start of the project, I won a major international title at one of the largest international stops in the world. And that just changed everything. That's when I got my sponsorship from Poker Stars. That's when I won a lot of money and decided, you know, let's try doing this full time for a year and actually play. And so I put the book on hold. I was taking notes the whole time. The book was never not going to come out, but my editor was very supportive and said, great, do what you have to do. So I signed this contract for a year with Poker Stars and traveled all over the world. So I spent 2018 traveling and playing poker everywhere from, you know, Las Vegas to Macau, just all over, everywhere, learning about this world, learning about the game, learning about the players, learning about myself, because ultimately this was one of the greatest journeys of self-discovery that I have ever been on. And it's not something I could have planned for, not something I could have ever envisioned, not a direction that I would have ever thought my life would take, especially as someone who doesn't like games, hates casinos, hates gambling, you know, hates that entire world. So it's definitely, it was an unforeseen adventure.
So what did you learn about yourself after all this? Like, what's your takeaway after this?
So much. First, I mean, I learned how much I didn't know about myself. Poker is one big therapy session. It was like, you know, talking to a shrink for hours and hours and hours and hours all at the same time, because it forces you to go through so many different emotions, so many different stages in such a short period of time. I learned some not great things about myself. I learned that I had internalized a lot of the stereotypes that society holds about females and how females should behave, that I was probably much more passive, that I would take shit from a lot of people, that I would, you know, just smile and, you know, let people push me around because I didn't want to antagonize anyone. I didn't want to speak up. I didn't want to, step on anyone's toes. I didn't want people to not like me. And I realized that about myself in poker because I was losing money because of it, because these tendencies actually came out at the table. And that wasn't great. And it was not a great realization to have about myself because I thought that I was stronger. You know, I thought that I was a strong female and a good role model. And I realized, actually, no, I'm modeling a lot of behaviors that aren't ideal for younger women. And so I think poker actually helped me get over that. I mean, I'm still not over it, but start getting over it and at least become aware of it. And I think become a stronger version of myself, someone who was better able to stand up for myself and kind of speak up for myself and realize that, you know, sometimes being passive is really not the best option. So I think that was one of the big takeaways. It also helped me with my emotional management and helped me figure out, you know, what things triggered me, what things made me upset. And it helped me work on that. It helped me become comfortable with uncertainty. It helped me become comfortable with not knowing. I'm someone who really, you know, I think before, I'm a very type A person. I like to control things. I like to think that, you know, I know what's going on. And poker makes you realize, you know, that ain't happening. That's not possible. You're never going to have all the information. You have to make a decision anyway. You're never going to know what's going to happen. They call it the future for a reason. You cannot predict it. And that's okay. Just make the best decision you can. Be comfortable in that world of uncertainty. And I think that's probably the biggest thing it taught me.
I mean, I'm surprised that it took poker to teach you that, given that you went through the medical situation.
Sure. Well, no, I mean, that teaches you that you can't control everything. But that doesn't mean you're comfortable with uncertainty, right? It means that you realize that I can't control it all. But it also doesn't suddenly cure you and make you let go of that. So I think the journey through poker made me more comfortable with that in every element of my life and realize that, you know what, ultimately, you just make the best decision you can and you move on and you focus on controlling what you can control. You focus on yourself. You focus on your own actions. You focus on your own reactions and you can't control the outside world. So let it be what it's going to be.
I mean, in many ways, that's very Russian too, right? because I think all of us who come from a different place, which has a lot of history, and where if you're not born with the right DNA, aka if your dad or mom is not somebody rich and famous, your life is defined. So you end up kind of creating these, you know, little gates around yourself so that you go through life without bumping into too many things. I mean, like when I got sick, the biggest thing which it did for me was I completely let go of this desire to be in control of the future. And I kind of reduced my days to today, tomorrow, and day after because everything else became very difficult to manage. And I think that was an interesting, so that's why I was like, if you're not well and you've seen your mortality so closely, you know, uncertainty becomes part of your being.
Absolutely.
And so, but I'm surprised by your comments around poker. So now no more poker or even, I mean, do you play for fun? Or
yeah, I mean, I was planning to keep playing for a while, but unfortunately, we don't know what the future holds. And COVID ended up becoming this big force and live poker is no longer possible. And when live poker once more becomes possible, I don't know if I'll be comfortable playing for a while. You know, the last place I want to be right now is inside a casino. When epidemiologists look at how diseases spread, they use poker because you're sitting next to each other. You're handling the same chips. You're handling the same cards. I mean, it's just the worst environment possible. So I do not see myself playing in 2020. We'll see about 2021. Honestly, I don't know if I'll feel comfortable at a poker table in a casino until there's a vaccine or at least a very good cure for COVID, because I don't think we should underestimate it. I think that's a fallacy of the human mind. If we didn't experience it personally, we think it's not that serious. One of the things poker teaches you is no, it's pretty damn serious.
So The Biggest Bluff is coming out this month.
Yeah, June 23rd.
Yeah. And so what next? Are you back to writing for The New Yorker, or are you going to write another book? It's like, you know, everybody
one day at a time. One day at a time. I haven't planned further out than the book release. So okay. we'll see what happens. But yes, I'm definitely going to be writing. But we'll see what happens. We'll see how the book release goes.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading the book, and it's been great to catch up. I hope, you know, you're safe and healthy, and it's clearly amazing to see you thrive, and you know, maybe, you know, one of these days we'll have three more episodes of Sherlock Holmes, and I'll send you an email then.
That sounds wonderful.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Mm-hmm.